This is the MedicCast Live, recorded April 14th, 2009, but coming out here on the MedicCast, April 20th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. And as I said, this is the recording recorded earlier this week on Tuesday night for our monthly MedicCast Live episode. And that was a great discussion on online medical consultation. How do we talk to our doctors and our nurses at the hospital when we're talking to them on the radio? What do they need to hear? What don't they need to hear? It was a great discussion. We had a special guest on, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. I want to remind you, though, that we have a very special sponsor of the show, and I want you to make sure you support our sponsors. So without further ado, let's jump right on in to the live recording from this past Tuesday night on Medical Consults. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this month's episode of the MedicCast Live. We're going to be talking about online medical direction and the art of giving a consult. And I truly believe it is an art, as something that was reminded to me by our state medical director in a recent protocol update, where he, in the recording, talked about the art of the consult on how to paint the picture for the doc on the other end of the line. How do you let them know what you're seeing? Sometimes you don't know what you're seeing. Sometimes you have a gut feeling. You've got to know how to talk about that and how to relay concerns that you have that you don't necessarily see in vital signs or other assessments that you're doing. We're going to be talking about all of that. And we're going to have some folks joining us in the chat room and also folks joining us on the phone lines. And if you are on the phone line, you can raise your hand to talk or ask a question or bring in a comment by hitting *8 to join us on your keypad. And that'll raise your hand here and I'll see that you have a question or want to be included and I'll bring you into the conversation. If you're in the chat room, there's a button at the top of your window. When you call in, you can just, once you're called in and logged in, you can hit that button and I'll be able to bring you up there as well. So that's that. We're going to move on in now that we've done the business of the call. We're going to go ahead and welcome our very special guest. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Ginger Campbell. And you'll see her in the chat room as Doc Artemis. And Ginger is an ER physician, has been since, I believe, 1992. And she actually gave me the idea for this month's episode because it is something that is something that she's kind of had some issues with recently, and she wanted to see what we thought about all of that. So we're going to go ahead and welcome Ginger now. Ginger, welcome to the MedicCast Live.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's a lot of fun to have you here. And Ginger is a podcaster as well. I urge you all to check out her show. She produces the Brain Science Podcast, where she really just delves into all kinds of issues having to do with the brain and neurology and understanding how our brains work. And if you haven't checked it out, I would urge you to do so. It's an amazing show. You can find it at brainsciencepodcast.com, and I'll drop that there into the chat room here in just a second. But you can also find her show over at the ProMed Network at promednetwork.com, where you find a lot of different medical programs, including the MedicCast and the Nursing Show and my sundry other podcasts that I do. But Ginger, what kind of gave you the idea to bring this topic up to me in an email? We kind of were shooting emails back and forth, and you kind of dropped it on me as an idea for my show.
Yeah, you were as part of the launch of the ProMed Network, we were brainstorming ideas for how we could get each other on our shows to sort of do cross promotions, and so it just came to my mind what was the most important interaction between paramedics and ER docs probably is over the radio, what they tell us before they bring us the patient so that we can be ready when they arrive is so important. And so that's, and like I mentioned before we started the show, when I started out, I worked in a situation where my ambulance crew was out of my hospital, small rural hospital, and about 90 miles from a major city in either direction. And the ambulance guys were so good at telling me what was happening on the radio. Usually in a rural hospital situation, there's a pretty good time gap between when they arrive and when they're on the scene. And so you have communication before you arrive. It's not, I'm at your door. It's, you know, some minutes are involved. And so that communication is really important for preparation. And since then, it seems like I find paramedics sometimes are rambling and not telling me what I need to know. I was wondering how I could communicate to them and also whether or not there was any training involved in how paramedics talk on the radio.
Well, and that's a good question that you brought up, because I'm trying to think back to when I started learning about using the radio and communications. And I know in Maryland, and I'm going to actually, you know, also throw this out to a friend of mine's in the chat room, Mike Sells. He's one of our EMS lieutenants, and he's working on his EMT program right now. But he is, you know, I think my memory serves me. That's done at the company level. At least in the state of Maryland, there's a chapter on EMS communications, and there's a little bit done on it in both the paramedic textbooks and the EMT basic textbooks that are out there. But to be honest with you, Ginger, it's no more than a page, and there's probably like an insert box there that gives you a rundown or an outline format of what you should cover. But there's no really like, it would be perfect thing for some kind of a practice session, I guess. Wouldn't you agree? You could do like some kind of a role play.
Yeah, but I guess we don't do that. And we in Alabama, we had several years ago we had to do some course that was to make us, you know, qualified to be the medical director on the phone. And I don't remember that we were taught what we were supposed to say on our end either.
So it's, everybody's kind of flying in the dark then.
It's almost like in medical school, they also don't tell you how to tell anybody that their family member has died. You know, kind of like the important stuff. They just expect you to learn on the job training.
Oh, and it's the same thing happens here. It is the... you know, when you have somebody that's pronounced at the scene, you know, have a priority four patient, and nobody tells you how you're supposed to turn around and tell the family members that, no, you're not going to start CPR. No, you're not going to do anything for them, that they're dead. And, so there's the first time I had to do that. Luckily, I had a county paramedic that was there standing next to me. And I turned to him and just looked at him with this like look on my face. And he just nodded and walked right past me and took over. And I learned from him, but I think you're right. I don't think anybody teaches this. And in a rural hospital, I suspect you're kind of thrown to the wolves. You're there by yourself in many cases. Is that correct?
Pretty much most of the time. Of course, I didn't start working in a rural hospital till I had a little experience under my belt. But I, back when I was in residency training, people still did moonlighting in those small hospitals, and you could get in that situation. I tried to avoid it myself. Now we're not even allowed to use moonlighters, so that really doesn't arise.
Well, that's probably a good thing, but you know, you're right. And I seem to remember, and I tried to look for this article, but I couldn't find it. But I seem to remember an article in GEMS about 3 or 4 years ago that talked about the fact that there had been a study done where they had the medics say specific things, recorded the calls on the base station, and then went back and gave a questionnaire to the ER physician to just check off things that they heard or didn't hear. And it was shocking to see that they missed about 50% of the consult. Now, was that because the consult ran on and on and on and on with extraneous information we didn't need to know? And so you kind of zoned out? I don't know, but it was kind of shocking to me. And, it kind of brought me around to make sure I put all the good stuff up front to try to make sure they got the big picture right away.
That's exactly. And you also have to remember that usually when you're calling in, it's not like the ER doctor sitting there waiting for your call, doing absolutely nothing else. I mean, unless it's 2 o'clock in the morning and things happen to be quiet, they're probably doing a bunch of other things and trying to listen to you at the same time as worrying about what they're going to do about the patients they're already taking care of, you know. So, yeah, being succinct is very important. And then I guess at most places, they still keep manual logs where you have to write down the basics of the patient's age and vital signs. Mm-hmm. But people tend to get focused on that because that's what usually the nurse is writing down as you're talking.
Right.
But those things, if they're normal, probably aren't the most important pieces of information, even though we get focused on them.
Yeah, it is something that I notice. I know in our area we had kind of a call from the medical director down to all the stations to make sure that we were giving vital signs on every single call because we were skipping vital signs. And you know, unfortunately, I think we notice that the vital signs are normal, or you know, are trending normally. They aren't alarming us, so we move to the most thing that we think is most important to tell you. But there's, if you're waiting for the vital signs on the other end of the radio, then I think they're expecting us to give vital signs first, at least give a quick rundown of the patient. So let's step back a second and talk a little bit, and I'm going to ask you to kind of take the lead here, Ginger. What do you want to hear when you first get on the radio? Do you look forward to hearing general patient information, age, sex, circumstances of the call, whether it's trauma, medical, whatever, and then a quick rundown of vital signs before you move into other assessment items? Or why don't you run down what you're looking for?
Okay, because my situation is such that there are several other hospitals within 10 minutes of me, I think the first thing I want to know is the ambulance coming to my hospital? Because sometimes you get calls that they're taking them somewhere else, you know? And so I think, and so this applies to any situation where there could be ambiguity. I'd say the first thing is we're coming to you with, and then the key idea of what you're coming with. We're coming to you with an MVA. We're 10 minutes out. We have one patient. He has blah, would be a good example.
Okay.
Now, if you're in a situation where the guys know you're coming to them, then that becomes redundant and you don't say that. So I think you really have to take, there's no one right answer. You have to, you know, go according to the circumstances you're working in. But I think how far away you are time-wise is always a key piece of information.
This is going to be different for every system in some cases. I know in Maryland, we actually call a central, the whole state
right.
is covered by a central central call center that then actually sends us to the hospital we're requesting online. And we can sometimes bring up other consult centers online if we're, you know, wanting to talk to the local hospital and the trauma center to see who wants them, because, you know, sometimes that happens. But that's also equally important to paint that picture. You know, do you think that patient maybe can go to the local hospital? Then you need to paint it that way, but give all the pertinent information to let the physicians make the call and determine whether it's a trauma center patient or not.
Yeah, and that's a good example of how it really does depend on the situation. For example, in Alabama, we do have a regional system around Birmingham that uses that computerized, centralized thing, but it hasn't made its way up into the part of the state that I work in. So anytime we have a trauma situation, the only options are calling a helicopter that's going to take them to the trauma center, but it's not a direct thing, or coming to us, and then we call a trauma center. So, and those decisions usually are made in the field. The paramedics in the field have the ability to call the helicopter separate from us, but it's not part of the central system. Does that make any sense? And I don't know how it varies in other states. I'm sure there's a lot of mixtures. I mean, Maryland is really, you know, I think has always been really at the forefront for doing these things in the most organized manner compared to the rest of us.
Well, and, you know, it's funny because if you're in Maryland, we just complain about how conservative the system is because
you have a really small area. Maryland's a relatively small state files-wise compared to Alabama's about the size of England. So, you know, there's a few more hours, you know, more miles worth to.
You're right, and we just look at, you know, how come we don't get this protocol until 2 years after everybody else does? Well, one of the reasons is we are, most areas of this state are never more than 20, maybe 30 minutes tops away from at least a local hospital, if not some kind of a major specialty center. And then we have the helicopter system that allows us to extend that and make it even a little bit faster. So you're right. I talked to, I was on an EMS Garage podcast last week, and was talking to one of the guys on the panel there, and he was saying, you know, our cardiac arrest survival rates haven't significantly improved, but, you know, we promise same-day service on our ambulances because, you know, they have, in some areas of their district, they have a 45-minute response time. So, you know, you get a cardiac arrest call in a place like that, it's hard, but you're right. Every district and every jurisdiction is going to have to deal with some different things, but I think you're right. There are some key things that we can do to make sure that everybody is able to participate and make sure that everybody is able to get the information that they need, both the physician and the provider talking. I'm going to drop in here and look at a I'm going to put a couple of links in there. Let me find it in my list here. Found one study talking about online medical control versus protocol-based EMS, and this is actual from a journal article from the Annals of Emergency Medicine back in 1997. Pretty old article, but I think based for this type of thing, it's pretty apropos. It does talk about that they compared the use of just protocols with online medical control, and they found that protocol-based medicine enabled the EMS providers to package the patients a little bit faster and get them to the hospital a little bit faster by just about a couple of minutes in their study. This is showing that there can be some decisions made outside of the hospital. But Ginger, I think you would agree there are always important times that we need to just check in and make sure that we have a physician close by on the radio to give us some additional direction with some of our patients that are, you know, priority two or especially priority one patients.
Yeah, I think that you make a good point that I hadn't really thought of is that since we've gone to so many protocols, we probably don't get called as soon. And maybe that's why I have the perception that the quality of the reports has gone down, is that I'm not taking into account that when I first started, we were called for orders that now they just do automatically on protocols. And so perhaps that has inadvertently decreased the level of communication that's going on. I don't have any problem with paramedics doing the stuff that's on the protocol, except for Narcan, because that just makes people puke right around the time they get to the door. But, you know, my attitude is if they're breathing, don't give them the Narcan. They're just going to puke when they hit the door. But that's a different subject. But what I really had in mind is making sure that we know what's coming rather than asking for us to tell you what to do, because for the most part, the protocols now cover most of that. I mean, there are situations when we're asked, and we certainly can handle that, but that's really not the situation I had in mind. It's really just feeling like I'm not in the loop of basic things like, say, an arrest patient where they don't tell me whether they've intubated the patient. Things like that, the basics.
Right, right. No, and well, but they need to, you know, you want some of the things you definitely need to tell somebody about when you're coming into the system. You need to tell your ER doc that your key interventions you've done. Are you, you know, if you're doing airway management, aggressive airway management on this patient, whether it's BLS airway management or ALS airway management, you need to know that this patient's being bagged, that this patient is, you know, is needing, you know, respiratory support of one form or another, because you need to call the respiratory therapist down and make sure you have all your ducks in a row when that patient arrives.
Yeah. So a good example would be, you know, you call, you say, I'm 5 minutes out with an elderly male patient in severe respiratory distress. That's more useful to me than knowing that he's 78 years old. I mean, you may say that just as quickly just because out of habit, but if you don't know how old the patient is, for example, you don't need to be wasting neurons trying to figure out how old they are at that moment. That's what I mean by focusing on what's really important.
Right, right.
And it is important to know that it's an elderly patient, because that's different from, if you tell me you're coming with a 5-year-old who's in severe respiratory distress, you know, that's a whole different ballgame, right?
Right, right. Well, you're thinking two different things when you've got a 75-year-old with respiratory distress. You start thinking cardiac or COPD. If you got a 5-year-old, you're thinking asthma or something like that, and definitely leads you in different directions.
Exactly.
So among those other things, Mike put in a link to the Maryland. There's a base station guidelines online consult record that you can look at. The people in the chat room can click on that link and bring up the PDF file. I have some other links here that I can throw out there for you all. You know, generally communications are like Ginger, you mentioned, is that we don't always have to call in, or we've done things and been able to use our protocol basis to treat the patients preliminarily. But we do need to call in on, you know, all priority one patients, because we're obviously should have some major interventions in place if that's the case. And priority two patients with, you know, persistent symptoms. This is coming out of the Maryland protocol. All priority two patients who have persistent symptoms or need further therapeutic interventions require online medical consult. So that's part of it. But I think what we need to think about is that, you know, maybe we need to practice a little bit more. And it sounds kind of silly, and role-playing, you know, is that just for kindergarten? Well, no, not if you're doing crappy medical consults. And this doesn't mean that everybody doesn't have one now and again, because I know sometimes I get on the radio and I can't believe, you know, I got the words mixed up or I forgot to say something. And, you know, I try to make every consult as good as possible, but sometimes you get on there and it's just, you just can't believe you said that on the radio, you know, whatever it was you just said. And I'm sure that the same thing holds true on your end, Ginger. Sometimes, it, you know, you didn't say what you thought you said.
So in Maryland, do you have situations where a crew would go to the hospital and without having called before they arrived at the ER without, as a part of protocol, that would be something you would do? I'm just looking at what they're saying in the chat room about the different ones that they call in, and I'm just wondering, is there a situation where you don't call, you just, like, say, a non-emergent patient, would you just show up? Because we have a problem with that, because we don't have very many beds, and if we don't know, my whole ER has 5 beds, and if I don't know that ambulance is coming and all my beds are full.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. Here's what the Maryland medical protocols say, and then I'll tell you what I do, which is a little bit different in a good way. Notification, which is noted as an information-only call, can be made through the EMS communication systems, or you can actually go through your local dispatch center and have them notify the receiving hospital for patients that are low-level priority 2 or priority 3 patients, i.e., such as a patient who's initially priority 2 because they're hypoglycemic. You know, you give them some D50 and they're essentially fine, but they want to go to the hospital. You know, they're no longer really a priority 2 patient. And do we need to do a whole full consult? So we don't technically have to call. However, I always felt like I couldn't show up somewhere if I hadn't been invited. So I try to notify the hospital. But I make it very clear in my consult that I don't need a physician, because we don't get a physician every time unless we ask for one. So usually a nurse answers the radio.
Right.
And then I just say, hi, I just wanted to give you a heads up. We're on our way in with, and I give them a quick rundown of the patient, quick vital signs, tell them the patient is stable, and we're going to be there in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever the case may be.
Right. And as EMT Dan's saying in the chat room, in a big city hospital, you probably wouldn't call them at all for those kinds of things. And that makes sense because they're so busy. It's a different situation. So I guess the focus of our conversation really should be those patients that are going to require immediate attention when they reach the ER door.
Right. And also, I think one other thing we can talk about too, Ginger, is and this goes back to that statement that a good patient consult is really an art, is because there are going to be those times when you are requesting an intervention from the physician. You know, you're requesting an additional dose of something that your protocol requires you to consult for. Or, and this goes about even down to EMTBs calling in for an additional dose of an EpiPen. You know, in that situation, you have to paint that picture in such a way, because I know I've had situations where I've had a patient in a significant amount of pain, and for whatever reason, I had a physician on the other end of the line that decided that I didn't need to have an extra dose in the wings in case the patient's pain wasn't resolved after the initial dose, say after 5 minutes of morphine. Could I give them some additional morphine to try to continue to take the edge off? And I've had it go both ways. I've had some physicians that say, go ahead, you know, you can have an additional 4 milligrams prepared if you need it. And others will say, no, that's just give them one dose and we'll see you when you get here. And I always fall back on, did I say something wrong in the consult when I was requesting that medication or that intervention?
Well, if your ER docs are like the ones around here, there's probably a few of them who are just stubborn to suggestions. You know, if the nurse says, would you like to do such and such? They'll go, no, even if it was a good idea.
Right. Well, and that's the sense I get sometimes, is that, you know, you have to take care of getting that done. And Mike Sells in the chat room brings up a good point. You really have to build a rapport with the physician in that short period of time to convince the doc to give you those extra doses. And the other side of that, Michael, is that if you know the ER doc, if you've been working in the system for a period of time and you know the physician that's on call that night, they know you on the radio too. I think if you've built that rapport up over time, your certain paramedics, I think, get permission to do a lot more than others in our system. And I've seen that happen. And I'm sure that happens in other areas of the country as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And unfortunately, in the two small areas I work in, there's been a lot of paramedic turnover recently because of things that have been going on with the ambulance companies. And there's quite a few of them that I don't necessarily trust. And that's an unfortunate situation to be in, especially for the patients. The patients are the ones that suffer from that.
Yeah, because there's times when there are things that we can do to assist the patient, and there are medications and interventions that we carry in the field, but they have their risks. And if you're not comfortable as a physician with that person's skill level, I can completely understand why you would hold off on an intervention with the thought that, hey, they're only 5 minutes away. I'll just be ready to handle that when they get here. I brought up some other resources, and let me look here, and I'll put them up here. I found a link online, and I'll drop that in the chat room for you. Shirley in the chat room saying, a lot of times we only talk to the nursing staff, and some of them question why we are bringing patients in at a certain priority level. And, you know, Shirley, that's kind of a judgment call. And you know, because I'm an RN as well, I can kind of speak to the two sides of the issue. Our focus in the field is so focused on emergency care and immediate life threats that things that we think that are really problematic, such as a lower blood pressure, and are not necessarily seen as essential intervention, you know, needing essential intervention by the staff at the hospital. That, you know, they monitor blood pressures, but I've watched patients with low blood pressures in the hospital setting, working in an ER, where they just, you know, they're just monitored because we have the, you know, they're being watched, but they're stable at that low blood pressure. Whereas we in the field, we tend to freak out if anyone's got a systolic less than 100 for whatever reason, even if that's their normal baseline. Ginger, have you seen that to be the case, that, you know, EMS providers overreact for things that you're a little more relaxed about?
Yeah, and of course, over the years, our attitudes about blood pressure have really changed. When I started out, I remember when Procardia was still on the truck. I was old enough to remember that. When I was an intern, you know, we got called all night long to give people stuff to lower their blood pressure to extents that we wouldn't do now, because we now recognize that sudden lowering of blood pressures is dangerous. So, I'm not so interested in numbers as I am is the patient talking to you.
Yeah, I agree. You know, there's so many things that we need to know what our blood pressures are. We need to know vital signs, because you need to know that for trending purposes. But it's much more important to know that they have an altered mental status that is non-standard, that they are cyanotic, that the diaphoretic, you know, and this is where the gut reaction thing comes into it. There are times when we sit there and we just have a feeling that this person's circling the drain. Maybe their vital signs aren't all pointing in that direction, but we need to always remember that there are medications patients take that alter their body's reaction to shock, and they may have a beta blocker on board that's artificially lowering their heart rate and blood pressure, even though they should be showing an early shock response with an increase in those values. And so you need to be aware of that.
You make a really good point, Jamie, because I what I want to hear from the paramedic is, if you have one of those patients where you have that gut reaction, I want you to tell me that. I want you to say, "Doc, I just don't like the way this guy looks." I mean, just be blunt. I mean, I had a patient once when I wasn't, for circumstances I won't get into, in the ER, but the nurse called me and said, I think this guy's got a AAA. And because she was an experienced nurse, and she was going by her gut. And so that told me, be here right now, you know, and it turned out he did. And that's the kind of stuff that is so important to communicate. And however you decide to communicate it with the doctor, I mean, if you know each other well, you may have some thing that you say that communicates that. One time I had a paramedic who, she just had this way of, she always sounded very chipper on the radio. So if her voice sounded sort of flat and business-like, that was my cue that the patient was serious. Now, I don't even know if she knew she was doing that, but that's, again, about knowing each other. But I want to hear about that. I think something's wrong. I have a bad feeling. That's the kind of stuff I want to know.
Yeah, and I think we need to remember that even though we're trying to sound super professional on the radio, and there's a difference between professionalism and communicating. And there are ways to communicate, and you need to be comfortable in your skills. Even if you're relatively new in the field, you need to be comfortable enough that if you have a feeling that there's something else going on behind the scenes, trust that. There's a lot of education that goes on getting you to become an EMTB, getting you to become a paramedic and beyond. And part of that education isn't necessarily in the forefront of your conscious mind, but it's there in your brain somewhere. And this could, you know, we could do a good ad here for Brain Science Podcast, but I'm sure you've covered topics like this on your show where, you know, there are things that we notice when we don't really notice that we're noticing it, if that makes sense.
There's a great new book on that called How We Decide by Jonah Lehrer. I think that's how you say his name, but he most of his examples come from airplane pilots in crisis situations. But the underlying theme is that little niggly feeling you have is, you know, it's important. You will regret it if you ignore that feeling. I think we all learn the hard way, never ignore that feeling. But yeah, for the guys that are just students, even when you're a student, you should still trust your gut. I mean, if it turns out that the person is okay and the thing you were worried about isn't there, that's okay. Don't be afraid of looking stupid. I mean, you know, I think it's okay to say, I am worried that maybe this patient, you know, has XYZ for whatever reason. Because sometimes just saying that makes the doctor at least consider the possibility. And he may say, no, he doesn't. I know he doesn't because, and give you a list of reasons that are based on, you know, his perspective. But you know, we get really narrow. You know, we think of all chest pains as heart attacks, for example, and can miss the less common things. So if your gut reaction is that this is something odd, speak up. I think that's really important.
And that's something that you're going to get a better feel for, yes, as you become more experienced in the field. But don't discount that even if you're on your first solo call outside of your precepting. It's important. I'm just talking to everybody out there right now. It's really important to trust yourselves, and it's hard to do that when you're brand spanking new. But that's what makes those old veterans, you know, where they walk into the room, they glance at the heart monitor, and they know exactly what's going on. And it's just because they've kind of developed this sensory awareness of the situation where they can just bring it all in one shot. You can't do that when you're brand new, but you still have that underlying knowledge base that's going to point you in a direction. And like Ginger said, you can't, if you're overreacting, it's okay. They can always downplay it. You know, they can always lower the response. It's just like we talk about with fire calls and EMS calls when we have motor vehicle accidents. You bring everything and you send home the ones you don't need. The same thing is true here. If you think something bad's going on, alert the physician, alert the hospital, let them know. And trust your gut. And if it isn't, you know, this is where, I'm sure you do this, Ginger, but this is where it's important to talk to the ER doc at if you have a moment at the end of the call, after you've dropped the patient off and you're putting the sheets back on your stretcher. If you have a moment, ask them, you know, this is what I was thinking, this is what I saw, and what do you think? And do you do any kind of that immediate feedback?
Absolutely. I really, that gives me more respect for the paramedic, no matter what his level of experience is, if he takes the time to ask me and talk to me, because that tells me that he's not just doing a job, that he's really passionate and cares about what he's doing. But another thing I wanted to say, Jamie, is that don't forget that when you're out in the field and you haven't gotten to the hospital yet, you are our eyes and ears and hands. And so even if it seems like it's something insignificant, if it's nagging at you, you should tell it to us.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that. Eyes and ears is a really good way to put it. We need to be thorough in our assessments, and especially at the scene of whatever it is, the house, the motor vehicle accident. You know, we're good at it in motor vehicle accidents. We move the airbags and look to see if the steering wheel is deformed. We look for starring on the windshield because we're taught to do that. But when we're in the home, we don't necessarily look around to look for signs of things like you know, the fact that the refrigerator's darn near empty and there's no food in the house at all, it could be an indication for an elderly patient that there are other issues underlying the current medical problem. And it's important for you to relay that information both to the physician and also to the nurse when you turn over care at the hospital, because the hospital has resources to help that person. There's social workers, there's connections with the community's social services, and that patient can be assisted so that you don't end up going back there five times a week for the next month.
I wanted to address what Shirley's talking about in the chat room about when you get questioned about your gut feelings.
Okay.
And I can't remember where I read this, but a lot of times medical personnel, when they trust their gut feelings, but then later on they will come up with I thought it because of XYZ. You know, our culture doesn't really tend to appreciate or validate gut feelings, and they tend to downplay it. And I do think there can be a point at which you put too much store in gut feelings in the, you know, sort of new agey way. But what I wanted to address was that if someone on the staff, be it a nurse, be it an ER doc, you know, gives you a hard time, you know, you will learn that, you know, some people just don't appreciate what you do by the way they should. Yeah, I mean, like she said, and Dan saying he turned out he was right. You just have to, like EMT Dan says in this chat room, you have to stick by your guns. Sometimes you're going to run into nurses and doctors that just, you know, they don't respect what you're doing. And that doesn't mean that you should give up, because sooner or later, somebody's life is going to depend on the fact that you did speak up.
Shirley and Dan, both of you, thank you very much for sharing that. I think it's important for everybody to know that, you know, you're going to have people that are not going to be, you know, chipper and cheery, either because it's a bad day for them or because they don't necessarily appreciate what we do. But we have to remember that we are those eyes and ears of the hospital on the scene, and that we are, you know, we are advocates for our patients. And so we are the ones that started the contact with them. And until we turn over care and complete that call and finish that run sheet, that's still our patient in some shape, you know, of the process. And we need to make sure that we are being an advocate for them and making sure that if they have a concern or we have a concern about their care, that we make sure that's passed on. And if we don't believe that the person, you know, whether it's the nurse we're talking to, is kind of blowing us off. And I've had this happen to me. You go in, you start to turn over care. There's some important information you want to relay, and the nurse is turned her back on you and she's talking to the patient. And, you know, that's not turning over care. And I know that nurse doesn't do that when they send that patient up to the floor, because every hospital I've ever been in has a whole host of checklists and protocols for turning over care and giving report. But yet sometimes we don't get that same courtesy. So you need to make sure that if that person's not listening, wait till they're done what they're doing. And when they come out, give them the rest of the report or the information that you think that they missed. And do it respectfully, because maybe they are just hopping busy like so many hospitals are, and are just kind of in that mode where they're moving on to the next item right away because they've got 10 other patients to get to.
Well, there's another aspect of that, Jamie. If I, as the physician, happen to be there when the patient comes in for whatever reason, because I happen to be there, because we think they're going to be needing immediate attention, you know, I'm probably going to want to look at the patient briefly before I talk to the paramedic, because looking at the patient sort of tells me what kind of questions I want to ask you. Does that make sense?
Oh, that makes absolutely good sense. Thank you for saying that.
And it bothers me if the paramedic rushes off before I actually have a chance to, you know, because sometimes there'll be something that, you know, I didn't realize it was important until I spent a few minutes with the patient. Then I go, I need to ask the paramedic, and then, oops, they're gone. So, you know, I wouldn't intentionally be rude to a paramedic, but I kind of like to get a quick eyeball on the patient. It helps me get a feel for what I want to ask them.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely fair. And that's why I said, you know, sometimes you need to just step back. From our perspective in the EMS side of things, we think they're rushing into, you know, you and the nurse are rushing into, you know, not listening to us. But we've got a patient, you know, they've got a patient now. And so it's still our patient, but now it's also their patient. And there are things that they need to do and need to assess and, you know, talk to them briefly or whatever. And that's why I say, you know, you need to, if that's the case, step back and wait till they're finished and then talk to them. And just like you said earlier, Ginger, you know, it's a very important and it to talk to the ER physicians. I know when I first became an EMT and I was in my 30s when I became an EMT. So I was an adult who was, you know, not shouldn't be afraid to talk to another adult, but I was scared to death to talk to the physicians in the ER. You know, I didn't want to bother them. I didn't want to be, you know, pain to them. I didn't want to, you know, but I've learned since then that, you know, they view us in most cases as part of the medical team. And they, like you said, we're the eyes and ears and hands on the street. And we need to have a rapport and we need to be able to ask questions about what we saw and what we might see in the future in a similar situation.
Exactly. And like you said, there's lots of stuff you know that we won't ever have access to if you don't share, like for example, what the situation was at the house. If you're working in a small area where you pick up some patients more than once, just being able to tell us whether or not you think this patient is really different from previous visits is important. That would be an example of something that I would want to know on the radio. If you called me and you say, I'm bringing you never say names on the radio anymore, but you say I'm bringing someone who's been there before, but tonight he seems different. That's an important piece of information because, you know, there's certain patients you can recognize their description without their name and the ER is going to go, oh, not him again, and sort of start to blow them off. And if you don't tell us, but this is different, I mean, that should be an upfront piece of information.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there are times I always, especially if I have a patient such as from a nursing home or from, you know, a patient that's a chronic, either because they're a chronic flyer on our program or we just have seen them a lot recently. I always try to tell the hospital this patient was in your facility 2 days ago. Because, you know, generally they're going back to the same facility if they've been in one recently. So I try to give the hospital a heads up because sometimes, you know who that person is just from the description of the age, you know, the age and the medical condition. If you saw them 2 days ago and you happen to be working or one of the nurses happened to be working, and I've seen that happen on the other side when I've been in the ER, you know, we sit there and go, oh, okay, wait a minute, I know who that is. And you go back and look in your past charts from a couple days ago, and sure enough, you can have that patient's chart sitting in front of you, which helps you greatly because you're better prepared for when they get there.
So why don't we address this issue that's come up in the chat room about if you're working at a place where when you get there, no one seems to have time to talk to you, whether it be the nurses or the doctors.
Well, and that's that, you know, I'd be interested to I guess we can get them to expand upon that a little bit. Because I know when that happens and there's one hospital that we go to in our district, and Mike will probably know which one it is. I'm not going to say the name on the air, Mike, and don't type it in the chat room either. but there is one hospital that we go to quite frequently, and they're really well known for just walking past you while you're standing there and ignoring you until you actually go and find somebody. But it has more to do with the fact that they're just so busy and they've got a lot of patients. And unless you've got a priority one or a high level priority two patient, they know they don't need to talk to you right that instant. And they're going to make you stand there for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes or longer. What do you see on your end? I don't know if that happens in your experience where you've been working, Ginger, or is that related to I guess we need to understand that we're all trying to do the same job, and if we're hopping busy, it's not easy to take care of everybody and be nice.
Yeah, I mean, I work at two really small hospitals, so it's different for me. One reason why I do that is just because I can't keep track of more than six people at one time. But and I know that these guys working at the big places, they are keeping track of a large number of patients all at once before you drop another one in the door. So that is a problem. Dan's talking about someone having to wait 45 minutes before he can give a handoff. Yeah, I don't know. You know, that's, you know, part of the problem we have with the emergency medicine system being overwhelmed these days, especially in urban areas.
Yeah, and I think that we need to recognize that, you know, part of the problem is we know there are more calls coming in our districts.
And you can't just sit there.
We can't tie up an ambulance, because that means that somebody else's district is going to have to come in and cover us. And, you know, I know for my service, we're 20 minutes from the hospital to get back in station. So if there's another call in our district and our couple of ambulances where we have are tied up, that means the next town over needs to come in and cover our district. And that's if they're not busy. And it becomes a cascading effect if ambulances are stacked up at the hospital. So from our perspective, we're just trying to get back out on the street. But from your side of things, and from the nurses' side of things, you know, they're trying to discharge patients so they can free up beds for your patient. They're trying to send patients and transfer them upstairs to the floor, to the ICU, to wherever they need to go so that they can clear up beds for your patient. And there are a lot of things that have to, and you know this, there are a lot of things that have to happen to get that done before that patient can be transferred to another unit.
So I guess that brings us almost back to where we started, though, which is the real issue is how can you communicate the most amount of information that really matters in the shortest amount of time? So could I suggest that maybe from the paramedics' point of view, to get into the habit of thinking in your mind beyond the vital signs, what is the most important thing that the doctor, nurses and doctors need to know about this patient and so on, you know, and have a, you know, so that once you get that, you know, short snippet of their time, you can tell them what really matters. And if that's all you get to tell them, they at least get what really matters.
I think that's really true, and I think it's a good place where we come back to as we finish up. We're kind of wrapping up the hour here, so I think that's a good place where we can bring it back. And I'm going to just kind of throw it out there. There's a couple people on the phone lines. So remember, you can *8 if you want to add your own comment on the phone and you're listening in. So if you'd like to join us, we're going to give you an opportunity to do that here. Ginger and I have been talking a lot, and maybe it'd be good to hear from a few other folks as we wrap up and have a few more minutes left. So I'm going to go ahead and open the phone lines here and talk to Dan and Dan. I think that we got two Dans on the lines here. And I'm opening both of you up, so feel free to jump in. I got EMT Dan on the line and Dan EMS Geek. And so please, either one of you.
Yeah, this is Dan, EMS Geek from New York. Great show. Some very, very useful information. I'm an ALS provider in upstate New York. Definitely some helpful stuff. If I can ask a slightly more specific question related to the communication and maybe get both your perspectives. When we call in, we'll always give some very basic information, usually the age, the gender, the acute complaint, the level of care we're transporting in ALS or BLS, and our ETA. And then if we feel we need to relay more information, we'll get on a separate radio system and then provide a telemetry report. Or something like a TIA, where maybe the patient is asymptomatic at this point. As a doctor or a paramedic in another system, would it be appropriate to still call in and give a telemetry report, that additional bit of information, for that TIA patient?
Ginger, I'll let you take that. I have a few points, but I suspect you'll probably say some of the same things I do.
Well, I think the answer is yes, as long as you're in a situation where that that's practical. I mean, you're not the 7,000th ambulance coming in at one time, and you know. But otherwise, I'd say yes. I mean, knowing that the person's had a TIA does mean that we're going to have to do things when they get there. And as I was talking about before, what I want to know is, you know, what I'm going to need to do when they're running. And so knowing that they've had a TIA, that's a pretty, you know, in most circumstances, going to mean that I want to see them quickly, not, you know, so that I would want to know that.
Yeah, that's where I was going too, Ginger. Patients that, and this is kind of something you learn as you do some reading and review things. But, and I'm sure, Dan, you probably already know this, patients with a TIA are at high risk for further stroke. And if a lot of, this is something we try to educate our public about, because a lot of times, you know, they have those stroke symptoms, but since they resolve, they either refuse or they don't even call 911. And then they have, you know, a major stroke 5 days, 7 days later. This is probably something that's been going on periodically, just based on my review of strokes and TIAs. And I would say that, you know, those patients, we need to get them into the system. We should treat them as a stroke patient for all intents and purposes, and get them into a stroke center if you have stroke centers in your system. That would be my way of handling that, because they do need certain drug therapies. They need some follow-up after the hospital visit. They need some good assessment at the hospital to see if there is any residual effects, and to get them to a point where they can have a full recovery and not any further strokes. And so you need... Go ahead.
Let's think about it this way. If you had a patient that you picked up for chest pain and their chest pain went away, would you think that meant you didn't need to call?
I absolutely agree with you guys, and I really ask the question because we've gotten mixed messages from both RNs and MDs at the receiving facility, specifically the stroke centers, saying, well, they're asymptomatic, why did you call? Or, you know, they had a TA, why didn't you call? So I'm curious to see, you know, what the world outside of our little system thinks about that.
Well, I just think that you're better off to call and get and have someone complain that you did than the other way around.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Thank you.
Oh, no problem, Dan. Thanks for your comment. So, EMT Dan, anything to throw into the conversation here?
No, I think that I work in kind of a different world, and it's really interesting to hear, you know, how things change in the smaller community. I've had a lot of close calls with my radio reports recently regarding CVAs. And in fact, I found out that a hospital had a clinical study going on for TPA up to 6 hours. And I didn't call in a report for a CVA after, I think, 5 hours, and they got angry at me. But, you know, it just highlights the necessity to know local protocols and to know, what the hospitals like to know, what kind of information they like to know. But I really thank you for this. This has been great.
Oh, well, I want to thank you all. I mean, part of what makes this, and Ginger will agree, is that there's so much interaction in the chat room, you guys calling in and being able to share your thoughts here. It is what makes this live show once a month such a lot of fun for me to do. And I think, Ginger, you've had some good ideas crop up here as well from the chat room.
I would like to encourage you to talk to the ER docs. Especially if you're a student, look for opportunities. I mean, if they're busy, that's one thing, but, you know, look for opportunities. Most of us really do like to teach when we get the chance, and don't take when someone's cranky because they're tired and busy to be a permanent condition. Look for opportunities.
Okay, well, that's going to kind of bring it down to a close. And Ginger, I think you made a good point. We need to make an effort to learn from the ER physicians with whom we interact, and open up opportunities when we have questions to take a few extra minutes and ask that question. And like Ginger said, it's going to raise you in the eyes of the physician because you went ahead and asked that question and wanted to learn. And I think that is important for all of us. We do so much continuing education, but there's no, There's no substitute for asking that specific question about a patient that you actually had hands on instead of doing scenarios out of a book in a classroom setting.
Absolutely.
Next month, we're going to be talking about new products, hot products that I saw while at the EMS Today show in Baltimore. And we'll have a few other guests on from some of the products that I had a chance to look at and interview about. And they'll be on next month's call. And that's going to be coming up on the second Tuesday, May 12th at 10 p.m. Eastern time. And that'll be the last call for this springtime. We'll take the summer off and join in again next fall. I want to thank everybody for being on the call. And I also want to thank especially Ginger Campbell. Dr. Ginger Campbell joins us. And really, Ginger, thanks you so much for sharing your expertise with us and your viewpoint. I think it was so great to have you on the call.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
And want to tell us a little bit about where we can find you on the web?
The best place to go is gingercampbellmd.com. You can get to both my podcasts, the Brain Science Podcast, and my second show, which is called Books and Ideas. You can get there from gingercampbellmd.com.
Great. Well, we'll definitely have a link to that in the show notes for the episode when it comes out on Sunday night.
Thanks.
And that's going to close out the episode that we recorded this past Tuesday night. Make sure you join us again, as I said, next month, coming up in May, and that'll be the second Tuesday night of the month at 10 p.m. Eastern time. We'll be talking about new products and new trends I saw at the recent EMS Today conference. We'll close out the show as I always do, reminding all of you that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Don't forget, folks, scene safety, BSI.